Reel.
And welcome everybody to the all new Threat Reel podcast. My name is Matt Shear, and I'll allow my co-host to introduce himself.
And my name is Micah K. Brown.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate everybody joining us. We released our first unofficial episode last week, which was our pilot episode, which is really just a way for us to sort of introduce ourselves to the audience and also have fun learning from our mistakes. And we made a few, but nonetheless, we were able to pull off. And I think that we're good to go this time. So with that, let's go ahead and start our episode. And tonight's episode, what I wanted to talk about first is Hafnium and sort of the fallout from that stuff. Before we begin, I do want to say that our participation in the podcast tonight is strictly our own views and personal opinions based somewhat on our experience, but in no way reflect or express the views or opinions of our employers. So let's go ahead and talk about Hafnium. And for those who haven't heard about that, it would be pretty hard because it was very newsworthy, I think, and it definitely made the news cycle rounds. It was a Microsoft Exchange zero day that was being exploited in the wild, and Microsoft released patches for it. Micah, go ahead and give us some background on the history of this.
Well, you know, as they say, beware the Ides of March. And so this broke, from my recollection, around March 3rd. And in going through and just hearing it go through and sweep through our industry, I know a lot of our fellow colleagues spent a lot of time downloading and updating our servers on an escalated basis. Now, the one thing that I think that is critical is the Hafnium does not directly go through and point to the specific vulnerabilities. That the Hafnium is actually a Chinese cyber espionage group that's exploiting four different zero days. And the goal of these four different zero days was to target on-premise Exchange servers so that they could log in and literally steal the entire content of Exchange servers. So this, in terms of criticality, absolutely very highly critical. And as for damage it could do to an organization, I mean, it was very, very severe. And what kind of went through, and as things matured with respect to this set of exploits, what I thought was really interesting is that on 3/9, Huntress, a cybersecurity firm, disclosed that more than 350 of its clients had been breached. Everything from small hotels to ice cream companies to manufacturers of various kitchen devices. One thing that I found really interesting in this was that it seemed like this had started as a very stealthy attack, but at some point they decided that they were going to go full speed once they thought that they had been caught, that they had been detected.
Yeah, and certainly 350 customers is a very large number for one entity to report. That is sort of staggering. And I think if I'm, and let me know if I'm getting this wrong, but I believe one of the other points of interest with this is that if you're strictly an Office 365, or you think of yourself as a strictly Office 365 organization, you maybe still weren't immune, because if I'm remembering correctly, I believe that if an organization had an OWA Outlook Web Access, aka webmail instance, running in their environment, that they were still vulnerable to this. And also the attribution I've read has been pointed to the Chinese. I haven't seen definitive evidence to prove that, so I just want to be real careful with the audience. That's the stuff that's what's been reported. I don't have reason to question it at this point. I just have not seen the data myself to do the attribution part of that.
Of course, attribution is very, very hard. You know, I'm just going through and I'm pulling from very well-respected news articles. And one thing that I really found interesting was on 3:15, the Wall Street Journal has an article, Microsoft probes whether leak played role in suspected Chinese hack. And aside from asserting it to the China-based Hafnium Group, in going back and looking at the logs, the Wall Street Journal sources were saying that this actually looks to have started back in January. So we had active exploitation that we, as IT security practitioners, were going through and we were missing. And then at some point, they decided to go from a very stealthy attack to trying to use as many of those exploits, establish as many footholds before people started to patch.
Yeah, that's an interesting tidbit. I think what I had heard, and perhaps incorrectly so, is that there were vulnerabilities that Microsoft knew about back in January, but obviously they can't just turn around patch cycles and release an out-of-band update the instant they know about it, especially with something like Exchange. One thing I've learned in the course of my IT career are that there are two things that the average user will just absolutely go berserk over. And one is that their phone stops working. Like, that's probably number one on most user lists of the users I've interacted with personally. Not too far behind that, though, is email. If there's the email outage, people absolutely go nuts, particularly if there's a phone and an email outage together. For myself, if I can't get phone calls and I can't get email, I'm ready to just kick back and celebrate because I can actually work on some interesting stuff or things that are on my to-do list or stuff I just haven't been able to get to. But the average users don't quite think the way I do on that. And it's definitely big because most places I have worked at honestly have used Exchange in some form or another, whether it's on-premises or in the cloud, Office 365, for example, I guess now Microsoft 365, or some sort of a hybrid solution. I've seen a lot of those kind of things. The other thing that Microsoft did is releasing indicators of compromise, for example, some file paths and things like that to look for potential compromise. To the best of my knowledge, organizations should definitely look for any indicators of compromise in their environment. And Microsoft provided some paths for looking for potential web shells. So I think the first thing places want to do is patch. And while that's going, start conducting some sort of incident response plan to look for indicators of compromise. Start doing your threat hunting and determining if that's within an environment and understand that aspect of it.
And I definitely saw that many mature organizations kind of had the patching as well as the threat hunting bifurcated and running in parallel. Another thing that I would ask is, how could we have detected, maybe not these specific exploits, but at the end of the day, it sounded like whoever this group was, they were after the raw data and getting the mail messages off of your Exchange server. So we should be able to go through and to maybe have some sort of detection techniques around a large amount of data going to a single IP address that is external.
Yeah, I think some of the other things are obviously monitoring for file integrity. Obviously, if you didn't install patches in an Exchange environment, probably shouldn't have new files suddenly appearing there, particularly with among the web files that are unaccounted for. In other words, if nobody made changes and you haven't installed any updates or any software packages and new files appear, that's something that should always raise an eyebrow. And I can kind of think back to a previous job I had. And one of the challenges was that we did a lot of web hosting, for example. The challenge there was to try to understand when something may have been compromised. Honestly, most of the time, we didn't find out till it was almost too late. In the beginning, what we would do is we would see that something was sending out enormous volumes of spam, for example. Things would start getting rate limited, where too much data was going out, so it starts slowing down the heavy mail volume from a particular server to more of a trickle, and it would show up in, you know, sort of the graphs and dashboards that we had. And you could definitely go back through and look at the logs. And so then it became an issue of having to pinpoint where that was coming from. And it took a little bit of digging through log files, but we were usually able to narrow that down. One of the challenges were, though, that we had some servers. We had very few web servers that were very beefy systems, and they served up tons and tons of websites. For example, we did a lot of hosting, and it was a combination of self-managed and third-party managed web hosting. Some of it was developed by our internal web developers that places would essentially, you know, contract that work out. They would purchase services from our professional web developers, and those tended to be pretty lean and very well maintained and had smaller attack surfaces. What I would see sometimes with third parties were CMS systems that might have a lot of themes or plugins installed. And so those were the things that probably got popped most often by threat actors. And once they were able to breach the security on the site, they would start setting up PHP mailers and blasting out spam campaigns. It was perhaps a little more innocent times in those regards, because the stuff that happens now is sometimes worse, particularly with command and control and ransomware, zombie hosts, which we did see a good bit of back then, but it seems like the situation's probably gotten worse. One of the challenges were that we had so many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of files on each server, was that we couldn't simply scan for malicious content, just to even catch the low-hanging fruit, because the amount of time it would take, you know, probably an entire week to scan an entire server just to understand what, you know, if anything happened. And sort of a flawed process if you think about it, because if you come in too early or too late, they can both be a problem. So, for example, too early is we scan something and it gets folders A through C, for example, on day one. And let's say you have a site in the B's. You get through the B's and it starts scanning the C's, and then something in the B's gets compromised. What happens with that is that you're going to then miss an entire week of stuff happening because it's already been scanned and the scanner's already moved on to what's next. If you scan too late, you might find something, or it gets detected at the end of the week, but the actual infection happened at the beginning of the week. So both are less than ideal situations. And I really challenged myself to figure out, well, how do I understand what's happened? What's changed? And that was sort of what made me think back to my old backup methodologies and some of the strategies we would use for that. The idea of doing incremental backups, you know, for example, just to understand where data had changed. And that the idea was that the backups would happen based on when something had changed if you weren't doing full backups.
So absolutely. I mean, the old theory around many backups, or at least the backups that I grew up on, was there's a special little bit on the file, and it would say, this is the last time this file has changed, and it would get updated. So as we go through our incrementals, we would go through and just backup only the files that had changed since the last backup had been taken. And then we do our full backups, say, on the weekends or our low volume time.
Sure. And the other word I was looking for is differential. But really the idea behind it, right, that stuck in my head was the fact that something had changed. So what I did is I actually did some scripting to put together a list of files that had changed on the system each night, and that process would only take about a few minutes to complete, because unless there was like a wide-scale update, things that changed on a system, you know, generally didn't happen all that often, and the things that did were easily, or things that could be easily validated by me. And so what I would do is I would produce this list of things where the timestamp, the modified or created timestamps, were less than 24 hours, would spit it out to a list, and then it would actually scan against that list. So it's a little bit of out-of-the-box thinking, but certainly a strategy like that on things that are public-facing, maybe not a terrible idea.
Not a terrible idea, but we do have to go through and take a look at potentially if a malicious adversary did know that that's how we were determining what to filter, they could overwrite those date-time files with relative ease. But I don't think that that would be something but a person that was in the most stealth mode possible would even think to do.
Yeah, and it depends on how the timestamps get generated. For example, if something is copied over and it reflects the new date versus the original date. And I think our situation was that, generally speaking, we picked up things that were on a transferred over date or new to the server. But yeah, that could vary from configuration to configuration, which is obviously an excellent point. And then again, you have to, something is better than nothing, and sometimes you have to start somewhere. So there are certainly other file integrity systems that are much more capable. And I know I've seen some. Tripwire's been around forever. That comes to mind. But there are definitely solutions out there that can help you identify when things have changed from your baseline to where they are today, that can help you identify those things. And it gives you a chance to review. I would actually look at the list of things that changed on a server. It didn't take me that long to skim, just really quickly skim through the list. And so if I saw a particular, couple sites, for example, that had changed, I would ask myself, do the files make sense? And a lot of times you could identify an update or a customer updating their content versus a system update or patch or whatever.
When you were reviewing it, were you reviewing it just on file name, or did you also append the location, the folder structure that it was in?
It was the full file path, including the file name that I would look at. And sometimes you can even tell by the names of the files. After looking at certain things for long enough, you kind of expect to see those. And then when you see something like x.php or 0.php, those kind of things tend to jump out. Like, that's not really normally a file you expect to find in a production CMS system, even within plugins and themes and those sort of things.
Indeed.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, Micah, I'm going to ask you about scanning strategies. Thank you for listening to the all-new Threat Real podcast. Join security engineer practitioners and show hosts Matt Shear and Micah Brown for new episodes on the second and fourth Friday each month. Available on all major podcast hosting platforms. With a technical focus, the Threat Real podcast interviews industry peers, discusses information security news, covers industry events, and reviews trends in cybersecurity. Visit us online at ThreatReal.com. Threat Real.
Would you like to hear your organization's ad playing during the next episode of the Threat Real podcast, or perhaps sponsor a monthly banner ad on ThreatReal.com? We are now accepting sponsorships. To get in on our affordable ground floor flat rate pricing for 2021, please contact us by emailing sponsor@ThreatReal.com for additional details. That's sponsor@ThreatReal.com.
As frequent speakers at information security conferences across the country, Threat Real podcast hosts Matt Shear and Micah Brown understand the importance of protecting valuable data. Compromised and rogue wireless access points make it possible for cybercriminals to hijack your data in transit, then steal login credentials, digital photos, financial data, personally identifiable information, private messages, and more. The best way to protect that information, other than powering down all your electronics, is by tunneling wireless connections through a securely encrypted VPN tunnel. Matt and Micah recommend using a VPN service offering extensive cross-platform support. ThreatRail podcast listeners are eligible for up to a 68% discount off NordVPN services. Please visit ThreatRail.com/NordVPN for details. Again, that's ThreatReal.com/NordVPN. Micah, please share your scanning strategies with our listeners.
PCI has taught me many things. One of them is that the results of a scan are indicative of a specific point in time of when the scan was run.
Definitely. And definitely one strategy. Now, Microsoft themselves actually did release some scripts to sort of help tell if you're vulnerable or if you've been compromised. They also had some things you had to more or less manually check on your own and dig into those things.
And that was on their blog that was published on 3.2. This is what we know about Hafnium.
I know it definitely appeared to come out of the blue. I wasn't expecting it until it hit, and then it just sort of ruined my day, just in terms of, well, more than one day, just in terms of having to dig through and look to see where are we exposed, what was potentially compromised, tracking where all things have been patched, and then looking through multiple times over, doing some basic hunting to try to determine if we've been breached, if we've been compromised, if so, where. And it was really a cross-team collaboration effort. So it really probably depends to some extent on how large an organization is in terms of, do you have just, you know, that one person who's the security person, the exchange administrator, and the domain administrator, or even a smaller team versus a large organization that has multiple departments that can assist on these sort of things. Regardless, you're probably in for a pretty long day if you were staying up on this and patching as soon as it came out. It was definitely critical. It was a very high rating. So everybody was encouraged to patch as soon as possible. I know a lot of places were told, if you haven't patched yet and it's a few days later, that you probably should just assume that you're already breached and rebuild exchange environments. And if you were breached, that probably was the right action to take, would be to, you know, sort of get your mailbox databases, get those things migrated somewhere, and probably just build new infrastructure around that and configure it as such. If you want to be thorough and you wanted to be safe, I don't know that there, you know, particularly if something was breached for a long time, had a web shell on it for a long time, and could have had indeterminable things done to that public-facing server, was definitely worth probably redoing the exchange just to be on the safe side. Because if you're not, think about what goes through corporate email. Think about your executives and people that have insider knowledge on an organization. In particular, just even think if it's a publicly traded company and you have threat actors that have essentially infiltrated the email infrastructure. That's why that's a serious thing, because think of all the communication, think of all the private and confidential information that gets sent through corporate email. It's just sort of staggering to think about. So these are definitely big vulnerabilities and nothing to be taken lightly.
Absolutely. So I did just go through and run the four CVEs through a quick search, and it looks like they were all 7.2 or above. The highest was an 8 point something. I forget the exact rating on that.
Okay, more than 8.
More than 8.
All right. Now, well, thank you for double checking. That's still pretty high.
Oh, it's very high. And I know that you and I have had the blessing, or you might call it a curse, of working for some very large organizations. And as I had talked with many of our colleagues that are in a similar boat, this got visibility at all levels of management.
Yeah, it definitely was very newsworthy at the time, and the word definitely spread pretty far and wide. I know that there were a lot of even executive management folks who may not be all that in tune with everything going on in security, but this was definitely newsworthy enough that definitely got a lot of attention, as it should have. I think in this case, that was absolutely the right thing to have happen. And yeah, for the people that were doing threat hunting on this, there were definitely IOCs to look for some of the threat hunters out there. There were at least a list of known web shell hashes that Microsoft released. They also included paths. One thing I didn't necessarily like on how they did the paths were that they assumed that the IIS component was based on the C drive. That may not be accurate in every organization. So when you see file paths, if they list C:\INET/pub/www/root/ASP.NET_client, bear in mind, if your Exchange environment is installed on the D drive or the E drive or something like that, that path could actually be a little bit different. So you have to know your organization and how your Exchange infrastructure is built out to understand where these files actually live. May or may not be directly on a C drive, for example. And some of the web shells that they listed, so just to help folks understand a little bit about what was happening with the exploit, is after a vulnerable host is exploited, what happens is the threat actors were uploading a web shell onto the system. And what that means is that that enables threat actors the ability to hop onto a system. It essentially creates a backdoor into the machine that, as long as the web shell is accessible from outside, it doesn't matter what security measures are bolted on afterwards, or even what when patches are released and that sort of thing, once something is exploited. And that's sort of why I talked earlier about the importance of rebuilding the infrastructure, because you could clean up a system, and if you miss that one web shell, it's very likely then that threat actors will find it and still be able to hop onto a system that you might think is otherwise mitigated and cleaned up.
And another thing to always keep in mind, especially for those that are within those larger organizations, it's not just about your primary domain. Many of us still have several legacy domains, so we need to make sure that we're going through and we're covering all of our environment.
That's an excellent point, Micah. You're absolutely right about that. So legacy environments, or even if somebody was testing out a newer version of Exchange, for example, and there was a dev test QA sort of environment that was out there, this didn't really care about what type of environment within an organization it was located. And the reality is, unless you're very well segmented and you know that for a fact, you're still very vulnerable to getting exploited and giving threat actors a foothold onto the network. And that's definitely a real problem, because if they're able to laterally move across, then they can take a leap in certain cases from a dev QA test environment to a production environment. The other thing to consider there is what type of information is in that dev test QA environment. If it has production data that was copied over as proof of concept, say, for example, your CEO's mailbox, a copy was made of that to put in that kind of a test environment, a non-production environment, it's entirely possible then for threat actors to get a hold of that mailbox. And the thing, if I've done some Exchange administration in the past, it's not too hard once you have access to an Exchange server to then export an entire mailbox into a PST file. In fact, that's typically how you migrate mailboxes. Some of the other interesting things that I found regarding Hafnium were the host IOX. So there were some examples, some file hashes, if you will, of known web shells that just look for, as well as some of the file paths like I talked about a moment ago, and then even some individual file names, such as some of the more innocuous looking ones are web.aspx, help.aspx, document.aspx, some other ones that are in there as well. Interestingly, I'm seeing in that list a healthcheck.aspx and ASP.NET_www.aspx. So definitely some ones in there. Shell.espx, that one sort of is almost a pretty easy giveaway. But also, some of the other things that I guess were most likely happening were that seeing some of the things that people should look for were LSAS dumps. So what that would entail is essentially some sort of a password credential dump happening on the system, sort of a post-exploitation thing, and maybe looking for those kind of memory dumps inside of a temp folder or the C root folder. But it's definitely some tools out there. Microsoft did have some scripts out there and so forth. One of the other interesting things I think I'd seen not long after that is that Microsoft was actually leveraging customers that were using Microsoft Defender to clean up web shells for known things that were found. This definitely got exploited. It's not theoretical or that critical patch that gets released that hasn't been exploited yet, or there's no proof of concepts out there or maybe there's only a proof of concept. These things were definitely getting exploited, and that was part of the reason this thing was sort of unleashed quickly. Anything else you would like to talk about that with regards to the articles that you may have perused regarding attribution on this?
So I stuck with a lot of my articles were from the Wall Street Journal, from the New York Times. Reuters was also a very influential resource to go through and to review. But, I just do not wish whatever entity that was to cause us that much pain for a little bit.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far off topic, but Microsoft actually did release some CVSS up to, I believe, 9.8, vulnerabilities, if you will, with Exchange. They haven't been exploited. I know I was struggling to find detection rules. Some of the things I tend to look for, so let me pick your brain on this. Some of the things I like to look for with regards to detection rules, I try to look at Sigma rules, Yara rules, to see if there are any known detections. Because one thing you want to try to do in an environment is get some sort of a monitoring and alerting in place wherever you can. That's one thing that I use. The other thing I try to do is I try to look at snort rules. That gets a little challenging, though, because a lot of times the good stuff only gets released to those paid subscriptions with snort rules. Sometimes if you're going to be waiting a little bit, if you're waiting for the community or even the registered user rule sets to be put out, do you have any places that you've used other than those sources?
So those are the types of tools that I use in my home lab when I'm just going through and I'm practicing my skill set for detecting these types of events. In my professional life, we go through and we use a lot of the commercial detections, and we lean very heavily on them to enable our nimble or agile SOC.
Fair enough. Yeah, they're definitely, that's the good thing is with a lot of the commercial tools is they are usually fairly quick to jump on those kind of things if they're known. And if they're known things, they sort of serve a good purpose of identifying potential exploit code. Definitely catch those signature-based things. Heuristics is maybe a little bit of a mixed bag. Sometimes heuristic detections work very well. Sometimes those could work better.
One thing that I was very encouraging to see was as this slowly rolled out, I saw a lot of people just publishing their own open source tools on GitHub, on Twitter, for others to go through and to review before they use.
Yeah, it's always good when things get out to the open source community, and in particular for community and peer review. It's extremely helpful. I guess one other source I should probably mention as well that I tend to look for things is I will sometimes search on InfoSec Twitter, and I will sort by essentially the date that something happened. In other words, I'll look at the latest to see, particularly if I'm looking for something that's brand new. Now, obviously, if I'm looking for something old or trying to recall how something worked in the past, then I won't use that feature. But if it's a hot button topic, for myself, I know I will actually use that. The other thing I really wanted to talk about and unpack on Hafnium is the most recent news on this is that the FBI actually went out and got court orders to essentially
get
blanket approval for hopping on to vulnerable systems that have been exploited and essentially patching them up and removing web shells and that sort of thing. I have really mixed feelings about this. I'll be really honest. I'm very conflicted. I think most everybody should be able to agree that ultimately we want this stuff cleaned up. Nobody wins when there are compromised systems out there that have web shells and they get backloaded with a lot of other malware, ransomware. We talked a little bit earlier about command and control servers, things like that. It's definitely not good to have web shells that are on systems that threat actors are taking advantage of for other nefarious purposes. So while on the one hand, I definitely want that stuff cleaned up, I'm definitely conflicted about the FBI being able to do it. And it's really the first time I can remember something like that happening. Obviously, the FBI has gotten involved when there were systems that were, for example, serving up malicious content or things that we absolutely wanted to get rid of and shutting down some operations. I know they've done it for things that were, you know, just sites that, regardless how people felt about it, that maybe had illegal things for sale or systems like that. I've actually seen sites where that, you know, after reading reports, going out to those sites and seeing the FBI takedown notices. So that's not new per se, but I think what's new for me are that essentially organizations that weren't doing their security to not just prevent, but not mitigate these problems. And for me, it's really odd to think that they can just hop on a private businesses or individual system and essentially remove the bad stuff and patch it up and then presumably hop off. But where I sort of struggle with this is that the government can do it. And I guess they, on the one hand, they have some court approval. But on the other hand, I don't know that they're notifying affected organizations. They're not letting affected organizations sort of have an opportunity to clean this stuff up themselves. They're just taking it upon themselves to do it. And where I struggle with this is who's watching the watchers. We'll be back with more Threat Real after these brief messages. Thank you for listening to the all-new Threat Real podcast. Join security engineer practitioners and show hosts Matt Shear and Micah Brown for new episodes on the second and fourth Friday each month. Available on all major podcast hosting platforms. With a technical focus, the Threat Real podcast interviews industry peers, discusses information security news, covers industry events, and reviews trends in cybersecurity. Visit us online at ThreatReal.com. Threat Real.
Would you like to hear your organization's ad playing during the next episode of the Threat Real podcast, or perhaps sponsor a monthly banner ad on ThreatReal.com? We are now accepting sponsorships. To get in on our affordable ground floor flat rate pricing for 2021, please contact us by emailing sponsor@ThreatReal.com for additional details. That's sponsor@ThreatReal.com.
As frequent speakers at information security conferences across the country, Threat Real podcast hosts Matt Shear and Micah Brown understand the importance of protecting valuable data. Compromised and rogue wireless access points make it possible for cybercriminals to hijack your data in transit, then steal login credentials, digital photos, financial data, personally identifiable information, private messages, and more. The best way to protect that information, other than powering down all your electronics, is by tunneling wireless connections through a securely encrypted VPN tunnel. Matt and Micah recommend using a VPN service offering extensive cross-platform support. ThreatRail podcast listeners are eligible for up to a 68% discount off NordVPN services. Please visit ThreatRail.com/NordVPN for details. Again, that's ThreatReal.com/NordVPN. we're back. Micah, when we went on break, I expressed some concerns around oversight. Do you have any yourself?
Absolutely, and that's a great point. And, you know, I've been grappling with this one question as well. And I think where I draw the line is I agree that patching is good. I also know from personal experience that patching may be low risk, but it's not no risk. There is a possibility that something could go wrong with the patch, and whatever system you're patching is just not going to work. So I think if I were designing this program, I think I'm all for the FBI reaching out, contacting, and then offering help, as that is what I would consider to be a public good, not to have these systems be breached, but them potentially not even notifying and getting the approval from the organization. I think that's just a step too far. Now, for those of you that are local to Cincinnati, you know that there is a group, the Cincinnati SMBA. And about 2 years ago, Matt, we had a very similar talk. And in this, there was a very common type of cable modem that was being distributed nationally by many different telecoms. And there was an IT security advocate that was tired of seeing all of these systems being popped and being taken over and people being exploited. So he started to go through and proactively obtain access through a known vulnerability. And then he would go through and restore those systems and patch them and kick the bad guys out. If I remember correctly, I believe that was definitely seen as an illegal action, as the individual did not get the correct permission in order to apply changes, and that opened them up to various legal liabilities. And if you guys are in the area and you don't come to our SMBA event, you definitely should. It's the hoppiest group in Cincinnati.
Yeah, and I definitely sat in on talks, for example, somebody that's notable within the information security space, Chris Roberts, Side Dragon, essentially talking about stuff similar to that. We're openly advocating for, we're the hackers. If we see problems in software, we should just go ahead and fix it ourselves without essentially sidestepping the process of trying to work with people. And I understand that can get frustrating, right? Particularly if you get no response. A pretty well-known penetration tester that has done a lot of notifications, and it's pretty disheartening to hear the lack of times that they've been contacted about things that were reported to them. And sometimes you just see that in action and you wonder, did it even ever get to a person? And if it did it just get ignored? Did it get addressed in private? I'm not sure I'm comfortable personally with that level of, let's just hop on and go ahead and fix it ourselves, and sort of trying to work through the appropriate channels be darned. And it can be tricky because sometimes it could even be something that has been deprecated. It could be an open source project that's been abandoned. It could be from a private company that has since gone out of business. So there's definitely some hard gray areas in there. And these are great conversation topics because I don't think there's really an easy answer. And if you ask 100 people, you might get 100 different opinions on this stuff. And some people will go from one end of the scale to the other. And I think for myself, in thinking, you know, in terms of Chris Roberts, he's kind of gotten himself into some trouble in the past by doing those kind of things. And on the one hand, you kind of, as a hacker, you kind of think, yeah, that's kind of nifty or funny, or it's somewhat admirable on one level. On the other hand, I personally don't know that I have that kind of a risk tolerance. I certainly don't personally. I don't think I would ever do that or just take over something and hop on and fix it, unless it was an organization. I'm talking outside of an organization that I work for, or you know, have direct access. I have authorized access, if you will. I'm talking about when it's not necessarily authorized access. And it's definitely a tough subject to tackle. And, you know, again, I'm sort of not really comfortable with the government just kind of doing that on their own. On the one hand, I kind of appreciate the end result. So it's definitely tough. Like, this is a really interesting subject. And I think another thing I think about with this is Microsoft putting fixes into their Defender product. Like, that's something you sort of expect because you have this product that you're using from this private company that on one level or another, you've ultimately paid money for. And you sort of understand how patches and definitions work. You kind of need that for things to work correctly and keep systems safe and keep things from getting breached and fix other problems. But like you said, and it was a brilliant point, Micah, there's no such thing as a perfect patch. Even those things come with a certain level of risk. But I think it's sort of, I don't know, I personally look at that as business as usual, almost the cost of doing business. There's a certain level of things that you tolerate, that you expect, that are commonplace. But I think the expectation there is that we have these products, we're using, you know, perhaps we're using their anti-malware solution in conjunction with the licensed operating system and the software on it. And we expect these sort of things to come from that vendor because ultimately they have the product that you're using. I think it's a little bit different when it's coming outside of a relationship like that, it's truly third party, in particular, if you don't know what's going on. What do you think?
So let's take this into the corporeal world. When I go through and I get into my vehicle, I put on my seatbelt. I don't expect anyone else to do that for me. Now, as an IT security practitioner, I view my current role is to evaluate risk and to advise to the appropriate person or group of people that can go through and either sign off and say, yes, we need to implement your recommendation, or no, we accept the risk. And in my personal view, I think that the end organization might have some reason why they want to update on their own schedule. Maybe they need to go through and wait until end of business in order to do it. Maybe there's some underlying factors that we're not aware of. The email system might need to remain up because it is providing critical business functionality. Those are things that an external person such as the FBI would just have no idea about.
Yeah, those are all great points and definitely worth thinking about. And it just, it was surprising to me just because I think I was kind of caught off guard by this happening. It's the first time I can really remember something quite like this most recent scenario and example here happening. And it's really interesting that it happened, you know, within about a month of sort of this hitting the news cycle. And then it's funny because every time you think this thing's starting to go away, then you start hearing about Microsoft and the things they've done in Defender. And then you hear all of a sudden that the government has just gone ahead and started taking matters into their own hands and fixing this. Theoretically, with approval from a court, but it's definitely interesting because they're not sort of targeting people that you might think of as victims rather than perpetrators in this case. And that is an interesting twist for me on this topic.
Absolutely. If the FBI goes through, contacts, and gets permission, I have no problem with it. Them doing it without notification, without permission, I just do not like that.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much right there with you. And again, this is a topic for a lot of gray area. There's definitely a lot of facets to it. So it's great to talk about and definitely interesting times that we're in to see something like this come to fruition.
So you went through and you brought in Windows Defender, and that's an interesting vector to just to dig a little bit in. So as we know, Windows Defender is built into Windows 10, and it provides a certain amount of flexibility or functionality. So as a user, I choose to run Windows 10 on my gaming laptop. And part of that is I know I'm going to have certain base Microsoft applications built in as part of the OS. You know, I love myself some Microsoft Edge. You've got Defender. You've got a couple other Microsoft programs. Please give us back that space pinball game. But, you know, as an administrator, I can go through and I can very easily turn off Windows Defender if I choose to. Now, I'm not saying that Windows Defender is the be all and end all of antivirus products, but I've actually been surprised as I've been tweaking with it and probing it. And yes, you're always going to have ways to go through and to bypass any type of control. That's just an artifact of technology. But for being built in and free, I've actually been quite surprised. But even though it's built in, I, as the administrator, still have the ability to turn that off. And that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of cool with Microsoft enhancing Defender, especially against this particular threat.
Yeah, I think, and I'm probably going to go off topic here a little bit, but one of the amazing things, I talked a little bit about scanning web servers for file changes so it could be done in probably about a 25-minute stretch, 20 to 25-minute stretch, which it was easy to repeat on a daily basis. But one of the interesting things I found were the differences between essentially scanning Linux servers with ClamAV versus Windows servers. And we actually offered both solutions because we had some platforms that depended on having a Windows backend versus people that didn't, you know, were pretty agnostic, might end up on a Linux web server, or they had specific Linux web server sort of needs. But one of the things I found that sort of surprised me was just the things that Microsoft Defender would find that were not found by other antivirus engines. And I'm talking about web-based files. For example, malicious PHP files. I was sort of always surprised that just their solution was better than some of the other solutions out there, commercial or open source. It was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, they've really made a very big investment in both their Windows Defender and their Windows Defender for Endpoint.
Yeah, definitely. So, all right, I think we've talked about that quite a bit. Why don't we go ahead and close out our show, cover some of the events that we are participating in. So for myself, I still have an upcoming talk at the Women's Security Alliance, known as WAMSA. I was supposed to give that talk on April 15th. Unfortunately, that got canceled not too far ahead of the event itself, just really days before the event was to occur. There was a notification in there that was going to reschedule. Unfortunately, that date has not been set, but I will announce that as soon as I have it. So we've got a rescheduled date to be announced, perhaps even to be determined and then to be announced. So definitely keep tuned in, and I will give updates on when that talk is happening. Also, I want to talk about I'm hosting the May SIMPA Security SIG meeting, which will be online, virtual meeting, so anybody can attend that. And I've got a couple good speakers. The first one is a talk titled, What is a Pen Tester? By Cameron Mayers, who is a senior penetration tester in our local area. And I'm going to be working with him actually in putting together perhaps a live demo on that. So should be good. And then I have a former coworker friend named Kevin Minus giving a talk on GCP security basics and automation. So anybody that's using the Google Cloud, that would be a good talk that people want to tune in on. And that's on Thursday, May 20th from 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Micah, what do you have coming up?
Well, excellent, Matt. I look forward to that event, I guarantee. That being said, just 48 hours ago, I recorded my RSA conference talk, and that will go through and be presented on the week of May 17th through the 20th. Also, I just learned that I got accepted to speak once again at the Central Ohio InfoSec Summit, May 24th through the 26th. Now, the Central Ohio InfoSec Summit, I really do enjoy that. It's out of Columbus. The local ISSA chapter puts on a great event. You get a lot of really good IT security practitioner style talks. And then my final gig that I've got booked is Circle CityCon, June 11th through the 13th. I was accepted both for a singles talk in which I'm going to be talking about how the Magic the Gathering card game set me up for a career in InfoSec, as well as I've got a tag team talk with a young and upcoming InfoSec superstar. I'm going to tease that just a little bit until we finish the talk a little bit more before I comment on that talk.
Great. And we're still thick in these pandemic times. Hopefully we're getting close to coming out of that. But all of these events, to the best of my knowledge, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they should be virtual online only events.
Yes, they are. However, I will be spending some of RSA Conf down at the Hofbräu House in the Beer Garden, I guarantee.
Great. Thank you so much, Micah. I appreciate everybody tuning in tonight for our first official episode of Threat Reel, and we will be releasing new episodes on the second and fourth Friday of each month. Hopefully, we will be available on all podcast hosting platforms. We're out there on most of them. I'm just waiting on a couple last ones to come through, and hopefully, we'll be on those very soon. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Wish us well. We're a couple of real security engineers facing real threats. All In Podcast Music, copyright 2021, Dave Whitener. Visit online at davewhitener.com/music. Used with permission by ThreatReel.